enough for Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
It is useless to resist us.
Yes, the irresistible Peter B. Collins Show. In your earbuds again, thanks for downloading, and feel free to share with friends. And it's people like... Created by Gail, I don't even know her last name, Mark Dennis, Janet Price, Wendy Bloom. They are voluntary subscribers to the Peter B. Collins Show, and they're keeping us on the web. We used to say on the air. And if you'd like to help and you're able, go to my website, peterbcollins.com. On the right-hand side of the homepage are the links where you can subscribe for as little as $5 a month, and every dime is appreciated. Toward the end of this podcast, Will Durst will join us once again to recap the top 10 comedic stories of the past decade. Wow, we completed a decade? That went by awful fast.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend. Smiling faces show no traces of the evil that lurks within.
Can you dig it?
Smiling faces sometimes.
But our lead interview in this podcast today is with Anand Gopal, the independent journalist who has spent most of the past 3 years in Afghanistan, covering on the ground in an unembedded manner. And he has brought us some very important news and information about our occupation of Afghanistan in previous conversations. He is working on a book right now, and you can read his dispatches at The Nation, in the Christian Science Monitor, also The New Republic, and he's affiliated with TomDispatch.com, and you can also visit his website. I'll link to it in the information at PeterBCollins.com, and it's AnandGopal.com. He joins us from snowbound New York City today. Welcome back to our program, Anand.
Thanks for having me.
And just a quick comparison, getting across Manhattan with a foot of snow and slogging through the mountains of Afghanistan. Any preference?
Well, I think today I'll take the mountains of Afghanistan because it's pretty bad in New York.
Oh, it is. Well, that's interesting. Well, I wanted to spend a little time talking with you today because we're going to mark 10 years of U.S. boots on the ground in Afghanistan in the coming year. And it's shocking to me and very disappointing that we had midterm elections this fall. And this massive deployment that is costly, that has 100,000 American uniformed soldiers on the ground and many contractors, too, there's no real end in sight. We are mired in a way that I find quite dispiriting. And to have it be completely absent from the debate in our midterm elections, neither party wanted to bring it up for their own political reasons, I think is really sad. And the media has followed suit. I saw a piece last week that in the calendar year 2010 up through mid-December, only 4% of news coverage was devoted to our military presence in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I believe that even includes the not-so-secret war in Pakistan. And so as a journalist, you must find it troubling that the issues that you have invested so much of your life and put your life on the line for are getting so little attention.
Well, it is, and particularly if we look at the way things are going on the ground. Without people back home paying much attention to what's happening, I think it's allowed policymakers, military officials, et cetera, to sort of push back any withdrawal date or drawdown date indefinitely. So before it was 2011, now they're talking about 2014. But still, there's murmurs that even come 2014, there still may be troops on the ground there. And I think it's partly related to the fact that people back here aren't really paying close attention to what's happening.
And the biggest story coming from Afghanistan of the year was broken by Rolling Stone and led to the resignation of General Stanley McChrystal. And there was some interesting information there, but it was really just a series of embarrassments to the president, not really a real huge policy gap there.
Well, that's right. I think if you talk to people in Washington, particularly close to the president, it doesn't seem that he actually has a clear policy prescription, but it's more about politicking and trying to keep the various people at bay happy. That includes the Pentagon and the State Department. What the Rolling Stone article did was it showed a great deal of dissatisfaction from, let's say, the Pentagon, particularly the military in Afghanistan, towards the White House, and it was more airing that publicly, which got him the axe more than anything about policy itself.
Right, yeah. And so we have very little debate in this country about a deployment that's going on to 10 years, our longest military deployment in American history. And it's not really going that well. Give me your thoughts as you look back at 2010. Is there any real evidence to support the contention of the December report from the Obama administration that while things are, quote unquote, fragile, that we have made gains?
Well, there are two ways to look at this. One way, which is the way the administration is looking at it, is that they've been killing a lot of Taliban, and this is true, mostly through night raids and targeted killings. Large numbers of Taliban mid-level field commanders, these sorts of people, are being killed, and it's causing a bit of strain on the insurgency. But despite that, and the other way to look at it is that they haven't been able to make any political victories against the insurgency. And by that I mean that the Taliban have grown to the extent that by the end of 2010, they control more territory than they have at any point during the last 9 years. The number of attacks caused by Taliban against the Afghan government or foreign troops are at all-time highs. The Afghan government remained extremely weak and considered to be ineffective. So if you're looking at those metrics, then things are really going in a very bad direction.
Mm-hmm. And we had some, you know, movement in the past year, starting in the first quarter. We saw that the U.S. was starting to target, and there was a dust-up over an individual whose name I can't summon right now. But he was captured by the Americans and prevented from engaging in talks with the Karzai government. And as the year progressed, we heard hints of talks, some of which were approved of by the United States, others apparently not. And then as we reached the fall, we learned that they had been investing a lot of time and effort negotiating with a guy who was an imposter. So how do you characterize relations between the Karzai government and the various factions arrayed against him that we call the Taliban, but that include diverse groups of fighters?
I think there is some willingness to engage in dialogue from the Afghan government and Karzai and these people. There's also a willingness to engage in dialogue from some of the most important parts of the Taliban or the various groups that make up the Taliban. However, that willingness, I don't think, exists in Washington. For example, there was a WikiLeaks cable that was buried amongst all those that were released a month ago or so, in which McChrystal and Eikenberry, the ambassador, were very clear that they were opposed to any sort of direct negotiations or any sort of talks that would end in a peace deal. Instead, what they wanted is surrender, unconditional surrender of the Taliban, which under the current circumstances isn't very realistic, of course, because the Taliban aren't losing, and you can't expect a side that's not losing to surrender. So this is a major policy difference or a major outlook difference between the various sides.
And the relationship between the Obama administration and Hamid Karzai, had a pretty turbulent year. There were times we were sniping at him, saying that he's drugged, he's crazy, he threatened to join the Taliban. And it seems that we have softened our approach to Karzai and stopped sniping at him in public. But how would you describe the uneasy relationship between Kabul and Washington?
I think the relationship is very poor at the moment. But at the same time, Washington feels like they don't have anybody else. A lot of this, I think, is both sides using the other as a scapegoat. When the war started going poorly, then people over here began to point fingers at Karzai and at his administration, not entirely without reason, but then Karzai at the same time would point it back at the U.S. And so it became sort of a vicious cycle where both sides were claiming things about the other. But then very quickly, Washington and people, the embassy in Afghanistan, realized that they'll only get so far by doing that, which is why I think a lot of these criticisms have been muted in public. But underneath the surface, they're still very much there. There's constant griping. When I talk to U.S. officials about Karzai, he's seen as part of the problem, not part of the solution there.
Mm-hmm. And at least publicly, we've made moves to try to pressure him to clean up corruption. And I recall hearing a report earlier this year that Afghanistan is roughly a $15 billion gross domestic product economy, but we're pumping somewhere between $50 and $100 billion a year in there in our spending, and that they've been peeling off massive amounts, billions, that leave the country and are transferred to, friendly tax havens where the money is being parked, presumably, for Karzai and his cronies. Has there been any shift that you've seen in terms of the financial corruption of the Karzai government?
No, there's been no shift at all. And part of the reason for that is that the corruption that we see in the Afghan government in Karzai is really just the tip of the iceberg. If we take a step back, we, the United States, are one of the root causes of corruption in Afghanistan because we're putting in billions upon billions of dollars into a desperately poor country that doesn't necessarily have the capacity to absorb all of that, and promoting local power brokers such as Karzai's brother, Ahmad Wali Karzai in Kandahar, promoting them, giving them contracts, and using them to help wage the war. And so from day one, we've been doing this and incentivizing corruption. And so Karzai and all these other people grew out of that. And so without taking a step back and looking at, I think, what's our role in all this, this kind of corruption we see from the government is going to continue.
And what about the opium crop this year? Was there a big harvest? And how much is that a source of cash both for the black market in Afghanistan and for the Taliban and its allies?
It was a big harvest again this year, and it was important, particularly in the south, but I think a lot of people, especially those on the ground in Afghanistan, think that the opium issue is a little bit overstated. For example, for the Taliban, they get revenue from all sorts of different sources, not just from opium. For example, from contracts from Western companies, for instance. So the opium crop was again a big crop this year, but it's only a small part of the larger problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, we can't really talk about Afghanistan without including Pakistan. And the U.S. Accelerated its use of unmanned drone strikes to almost one a day over the Bush administration, which had been using them relatively sparingly. And we saw an official leak, and it's important to note that two recent leaks that are significant related to our military presence in that part of the world had nothing to do with Julian Assange, his sex life, or WikiLeaks. And that is the exposure of the top CIA guy in Pakistan. We believe that was retaliation for an American lawsuit that exposed an ISI counterpart here in the States. And also, the New York Times revelation of the so-called secret plans to further expand the use of drones in Pakistan and to really amp up our efforts to limit the cross-border support of forces in Afghanistan. Give me your comments on that, Anand Gopal.
Well, to start with the New York Times revelation, there's some talk about expanding the drone program, which is currently just focused on these border areas, these tribal areas between Afghanistan and Pakistan, but expanding them out of those areas and into more populated urban areas, for example, Baluchistan or elsewhere, which is a prospect deeply worrying and upsetting to a lot of Pakistanis and Pakistani officials because it would be very, very destabilizing. These are areas that are extremely different from the kind of places where we're firing drones at right now, which are very sort of rugged, rural, sparsely populated areas. And there's already a very latent, deep-seated anti-American sentiment in those areas right now. Further strikes outside of those areas could really inflame sentiment.
And why do we seem so unconcerned about the so-called collateral damage? Because when we operate in a fully remote-control manner, such as using these drones, many of which are controlled like a Nintendo game from an Air Force base near Las Vegas called Creech, and we use information that we rely on that comes from Pakistani intelligence sources, and I consider that to be very unreliable and that we may end up settling scores that they have rather than trying to advance our stated interests of wiping out Taliban and alleged al-Qaeda fighters. And yet when we use this technique, it certainly preserves American lives, but we have no real idea of who we are killing and who beyond the targets are being killed or wounded in these assaults. And so I find the, you know, prospect of expanding the use of drones extremely troubling.
Well, that's right. And the drones that are being used right now, as you mentioned, are mostly being used towards Pakistan's enemies. Not entirely, but for the most part, those militant groups that are right now or have been fighting against the Pakistani state, and not necessarily against, let's say, the Afghan Taliban, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the things that what the New York Times article is referencing as a reason to expand the drone program, because a lot of these Afghan Taliban leaders aren't in those border areas. They're sitting in the Pakistani city of Quetta, mm-hmm. or in Karachi, and wanting to fire missiles into those regions for that reason. But it is extremely problematic, and yes, I think in the short term, it's not going to put any American lives at risk because there's no soldiers on the ground, but of course, there's always the issue of blowback, and we don't know how these things will play out in the future and what that means for, let's say, troops in Afghanistan.
And while it does protect American troops, and I understand that motivation, I believe that it puts us as a nation at greater risk because of the reaction of people on the ground. And I'm still thinking of that brave female college student who took on Secretary of State Clinton in the fall of 2009, when she went to a public meeting in Pakistan, and this young woman just said, "You're summarily executing people, and you don't even have a legal basis to, you know, operate inside our country. There's no UN resolution. There's no Pakistani resolution. There's no American declaration of war or authorization for this use of military force. So we are operating as a terrorist would, and expecting that because we think that what we're doing is right," and when I say we, I guess I don't include myself. It's a very royal we. But it just seems to me that we're not looking at the big picture and the long-term impact.
Well, that's right. And even if you want to look at it purely in terms of national security, what Pakistanis think about the United States matters. It matters a lot. And I think you're absolutely right that they, ordinary Pakistanis, particularly those in the cities like Karachi and Islamabad, view these sorts of attacks as provocations, as terrorist attacks, and it helps inform their opinion of the United States and contributes to a general sort of level of radicalization that exists in the country right now, which can't be good for national security, and it's also not good in terms of what's happening in Afghanistan.
And if I can put you on the spot, did you have any conversations with people who articulated that in a particularly effective way, Anand, that impressed you? Because I feel that our media doesn't bring the perspectives of other nations to American viewers and readers.
Well, absolutely. I mean, when speaking to Pakistanis, most Pakistanis view everything that's happening in Afghanistan right now and the drone attacks in Pakistan as a war of aggression by the United States. That may not be how people here see it, but just to give a sense of what other people there are thinking. And they view this, they don't really see the connection, you know, sitting in, let's say, Karachi. You see, view the connection between events that happened 10 years ago and firing missiles into mountains in Waziristan. And so they call the Americans invaders, they call them occupiers, all sorts of things. And it feeds into that sentiment that, again, as I mentioned, this is something that we have to start thinking about the long-term implications of these sorts of things without just looking in the short term.
Indeed. Anand, what is your sense of the impact of the recent death of Richard Holbrooke, who was the Obama administration's special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Well, my understanding is that Holbrooke was actually one of the people who was more open towards an eventual peace deal or settlement within the administration. So in that regard, it's unfortunate that he's no longer there to push that point of view, and it remains to be seen if anybody else will take up that mantle, because right now I think we've moved a little bit away from even considering that as a possibility, especially with General Petraeus, who's very much a hawk on this issue. He's set against any sort of negotiations or any sort of peace deal without actually being able to declare some sort of victory before doing that.
Then with Holbrooke gone, is Vice President Biden really the most open leader in our administration in terms of being willing to consider some sort of talks leading to some sort of a settlement?
That's my impression. Although, even though he's the vice president, I don't know how much sway he would have in terms of being able to push that compared to somebody like Petraeus, who's on the ground and has enormous amounts of respect in Washington and is seen as the brilliant strategist and the person who can really be the one who can say when it's the right time to push for negotiations.
Yeah, nobody will ever compare Biden to Cheney and say that he's running the show there. You know, and
for sure.
I have my own mixed feelings about Joe Biden on foreign policy, but the extent to which he's been a reasoning voice on Afghanistan, I do appreciate that. Now, I referred earlier to the fake Taliban, the imposter, who we were, you know, secretly flying into Kabul and we were feeding him cash. How did that happen? How can we end up being snookered in such a strategically important situation where we appear to spend billions on intelligence and somebody ought to know?
Well, yeah, and I think it shows how little we do know. In this case, the Taliban commanders had brought forth this person and tried to pass him off, or did pass him off as a very high-ranking Taliban leader, and the various intelligence agencies, which include the British and the CIA and Afghan intelligence agencies, took him in and started meeting him and paying him off over the course of months. And I believe my understanding is that the Taliban themselves had pushed this person forward in perhaps to sort of test the waters and see what the reaction of the Americans would be. And the intelligence agencies may have been behind this as well. But the whole thing really brings to mind the question, if we don't even know who we're talking to, how do we know who we're killing?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it got very little play in the United States. I mean, there was some reporting on it, but it faded pretty quickly. Now, Anand, one of the things that you brought to our attention in dispatches that you wrote for Tom Dispatch and I believe for The Nation last year, and some that also appeared in the Wall Street Journal, you disclosed the fairly widespread use of night raids by U.S./NATO forces in Afghanistan. And it appears, based on the reporting recently, that this has actually expanded. And in the past week, we have a botched night raid where NATO forces attacked a contractor working for our side. And this went beyond embarrassment. Tiger International is the firm that was targeted here. And this, you know, shows, well, let me just add here, based on reporting from McClatchy newspapers, since mid-September, special forces with U.S.-led military coalition, with the U.S.-led military coalition, have conducted at least 1,780 such operations, ending with the death or arrest of 880 alleged insurgent leaders and the capture of more than 2,300 fighters. So this is now a tactic that, since you and I spoke earlier in the year, that has been widely expanded by American-led forces.
Yeah, particularly under General Petraeus, it's really expanded. And this particular case that you're referencing, which took place in Kabul, the only reason we know about it is because it took place in Kabul. There are dozens of other cases like this throughout the country that happen all the time, in which people are wrongfully killed or are arrested. And like as I said before, we don't even know who we are talking to. It's hard to fathom that we know who we're killing or capturing. Of those 2,300 suspected insurgents, there's no way of actually knowing how many of those are actually insurgents. And if they all are actually insurgents, then that really says something about the capabilities of the Taliban, where 2,300 of their fighters have been moved from the battlefield, and still they are able to increase the level of attacks every year.
And this also apparently violates an agreement we have with the Karzai government, that at least in Kabul, that we will have that we would give notice to local police forces before carrying out a raid like this, and that we would have Afghan security forces fronting it. Comment on that.
Well, that's right, and not only in this case, but in general, U.S. forces have told the Afghan government that they will always partner Afghan forces with Americans when doing raids throughout the country, and that almost never happens. Or if it does happen, the Afghan forces that are in question are these shadowy militia groups that are not directly tied to the Afghan army in any way. And this has been a constant source of consternation from Kabul.
Mm-hmm. And this leads to another topic I wanted to bring up, which is the use of armed contractors. We have seen Karzai try to boot them out of the country, and he has been persuaded to delay enforcing that edict. The United States maintains that it could not continue its presence and properly protect particularly State Department officials in Afghanistan without these mercenaries.
Well, there are mercenaries that the U.S. government is using. There are people who are going and protecting, for example, USAID projects. And these are pretty massive undertakings, billions of dollars, in which they require security, otherwise they'll be attacked or they'll have funds stolen from them. But the many smaller NGOs and independent NGOs, including international NGOs that do work in Afghanistan, don't actually require these private security companies. And so from the Afghan government's point of view, these private security companies are mostly associated with those organizations which are most notorious for fraud and waste, for example, USAID and these other, or Louis Berger or various other big contracting companies in from the United States. And that is sort of the impetus behind this from Karzai.
Mm-hmm. And what is the current status of that? He delayed it, but I don't recall what the deferred deadline is.
I believe he's delayed it indefinitely, and he's stepped back from some of the more harsher strictures that he had pushed forth. So at first he was threatening to shut down all private security companies, and now he's allowed private security companies associated with international organizations to stay there. So what's happened is he's been able to shut down the private security companies of a lot of his rivals. Because if you remember, Karzai and his family himself, they own private security companies as well. And so the foreigners get to maintain their private security companies, and Karzai and his people get to maintain theirs, but then his rivals get squeezed out.
Oh, boy. What a mess. Now, at the time you reported on the night raids, Anand, you also reported to us a number, and I believe it was somewhere under 10, of secret sites, black sites, where that were being used as kind of field detention centers. And as I recall, some of the people being held there were not people who had been captured locally, that these are being used as warehouses. What can you tell us about the current status of U.S.-controlled detention sites in Afghanistan? And I'll follow up and ask separately about Bagram, okay?
Well, sure. So there are these network of field detention sites throughout the country, which has largely stayed intact through Obama administration and through General Petraeus's reign here in Afghanistan. And they take people from all around the country, and they'll either fly them on a helicopter or take them on the road to these detention centers that are usually on U.S. military bases, and they'll use these areas for interrogation and then move them on after a few days to Bagram.
Mm-hmm. And has there been any expansion, or have there been any reported incidents that would expose torture or other atrocities?
Nothing since I last reported on this about a year ago. So we don't know. I think these sorts of things would take a bit of digging to find out, because a lot of this is kept under wraps.
Mm-hmm. And what about Bagram? What is the current status there? We know that at least stateside, the Obama government went to great lengths to prevent even the disclosure of the names and nationalities of the prisoners being held at Bagram.
Well, the ISAF, or the foreign forces in Afghanistan, have opened up a new detention facility in Bagram, which has more modern amenities than the previous one, and supposedly is more humane towards the prisoners. At the same time, there is also a second detention facility, which prisoners call the Black Jail, which the Red Cross doesn't have access to, which is still functioning, as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a place which there's been a lot of allegations of abuse at the hands of U.S. authorities.
And do we have any idea of the capacity of the black site at Bagram?
Again, it looks like it's an area for short-term detention and interrogation before moving prisoners onwards to a more longer-term detention site, such as the new facility they just built.
Okay. And any idea of the headcount there, or is that all being kept under wraps?
Kept very much under wraps. Like I said, even the Red Cross does not have access to this. It's very difficult to get some visibility there.
Mm-hmm. Now, net-net, what do you think that WikiLeaks has added to our knowledge of the situations in Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Well, most importantly, the leaks, especially the first set of leaks that came in the summer, I think they show that there's a lot more civilian casualties than we were aware of, or that's at least what's been reported. And people who follow the news out of Afghanistan, they'll see that the United Nations puts out a report every 3 or 4 months tallying the civilian casualties. If you compare this to what WikiLeaks has come out with, it's clear that these numbers are woefully inaccurate, and there's a lot of civilian deaths happening that we're not aware of.
Mm-hmm. And what other kind of chatter, because I've been a little suspicious of some of the cherry-picked WikiLeaks information that's been published in the corporate media. Have you been able to delve into some of the raw files and dig through them yourself? And was there anything that you found that we haven't seen in the New York Times or the other papers that have been working with WikiLeaks?
I have not been able to. What the WikiLeaks have done in this round of leaks, as opposed to the previous round, is that they are working just with these six or seven major news organizations and releasing the trove of files to them. And for other researchers to get access to it, it's proved to be quite difficult. I don't know if that's because of Assange's current legal troubles, that he's perhaps tied up in other things, but I've been trying to get access to the full data set, but have not been successful.
Yeah, I kind of gave up. I was logging onto the site trying to get some of the State Department cables, and it just, you know, I don't know if there's been denial of access. I've tried a lot of the mirror sites that I've been able to find, but have not been able to really access any of that raw information myself. Anand, next let's turn to the statements that were made earlier in this year when McChrystal was still running the show in Afghanistan. And he said that Marja was going to be a kind of test case. And he said, we're going to roll in there, we're going to pacify it, we're going to install a government in a box. And it proved to be much more difficult. And my sense is that we scaled back our expectations in order to ultimately declare some form of success. But what would you describe, who currently controls Marja, and to what extent did the U.S. and NATO forces succeed in taking control of it?
Marja is a broad area of mostly farming villages with a couple of bazaars where there's shops and government offices. Those two or three bazaars are controlled by government forces, but everything surrounding that, all these the vast swaths of rural countryside, are still under effective control of the Taliban. So I think that, more than anything, is a very clear demonstration that the surge into Marja has failed.
Mm-hmm.
There were 15,000 troops, I believe, pushing in there in the beginning, and even 15,000 troops weren't enough to be able to compete with the Taliban on the level in which they operate, which is in the mosques and the schools, in the field, working alongside the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very difficult for the U.S. troops to compete with that, and this is why the Taliban still have an extraordinary degree of influence there.
And what about Kandahar? What is the current status of Kandahar?
Well, U.S. forces pushed into the western parts of Kandahar in September and October, and they were able to clear the area for the most part, of the Taliban, similarly to what they did in Marja. For the most part, the Taliban didn't stand and fight. They fled. A lot of the leadership fled to Pakistan. The Taliban had been under a lot of military pressure. But again, the same problem here is that the U.S. and the Afghan government haven't been able to translate these military successes into political successes, where they've been able to establish a lasting presence that can compete with the Taliban at the village level, in the mosques and in the schools. They haven't been able to install a government there that can inspire allegiance from the local population. And so there is concern that even though the Taliban have fled, for the most part, into Pakistan, that come spring they'll be right back where they were.
And Anand, at your website, you have posted a summary or an excerpt version of a paper that was released by the New American Foundation this fall called The Battle for Afghanistan, subtitled Militancy and Conflict in Kandahar. And I'd like to read a somewhat lengthy quote here, because I think that it would help our listeners understand some much-needed context and history, which we rarely get from the media in this country, in particular television. You wrote, "The failure to grant amnesty to Taliban figures who had abandoned the movement and accepted the new Afghan government had repercussions far beyond the specific individuals targeted. Soon, a sense began to develop among those formerly connected to the regime, from senior officials to rank-and-file fighters, that there was no place for them in the post-2001 society. In the Bondi Timor area of Maiwand, for instance, former civil aviation minister and leading Taliban official Mullah Akhtar Mohammad Mansour had accepted the new government and was living at home. But the violent drive against former Taliban by Sherzai's network and U.S. Special Forces led Mansour to realize it would be foolish to stay in Afghanistan. He said that this government wouldn't let him live in peace, recalled lawmaker Ahmad Shah Achakzai, who had met him during that time. It wasn't a surprise to us when he finally fled to Pakistan and rejoined the Taliban. Today, Mansour is a leading figure in the movement and one of the replacements for captured Taliban leader Mullah Baradar." And he was the guy whose name I was looking for earlier in this conversation. And you go on. "Even after fleeing to Pakistan, large segments of the leadership were still open to returning to Afghanistan and abandoning the fight. In 2002, for instance, the entire senior leadership, except for Omar himself, gathered in Karachi, Pakistan, for a meeting organized by former Taliban officials. The group agreed in principle to find a way for them to return to Afghanistan and abandon the fight. But lack of political will by the central government in Kabul and opposition from some sections of U.S. leadership meant that such approaches were ultimately ignored." Now, I see this as very important background and again, context for what we see in such a narrow view in just the very present tense. And it really helps us understand that missteps under the Bush military team in Afghanistan are paying negative dividends to the U.S. occupation, and that we, in fact, were part of the radicalization and militarization of people who otherwise might have been pacified and supported the Karzai government.
Well, that's right. A lot of these Taliban leaders, people who are leading the insurgency today, they didn't, when the U.S. invasion happened and when the government, Taliban government was ousted, they didn't all of a sudden stand up and declare jihad or declare a resistance against the occupying forces immediately. It took a number of years for that to develop, and in large part that was because of the consequences of policies that Washington had in 2002 and 2003, in which Taliban leaders were to be hunted and killed at any cost. And so they were special forces raids, and they were private Afghan militias that were going and capturing these people, and cases of torture and abuse. And in many ways, as I quote said, a lot of these former Taliban figures felt they had no choice but to reorganize and fight against the Americans.
Mm-hmm. Wow. When we understand, you know, these deeper issues and you know, how some of these things developed, it just, you know, points out to me how hardened the situation is against the United States and how truly hopeless it appears to be able to create some sort of basis for a stable government in Kabul and some sort of reconciliation with the fighting forces, again, that we lump together as the Taliban, but that include the Haqqani Network and other smaller groups who probably will not support the central government whenever the U.S. decides to leave.
That's right, and I can tell you a story about the Haqqani Network. Haqqanis are one of the most dangerous foes of the United States in Afghanistan. The brother of the leader of the Haqqani Network in 2003 or 2004 came to Afghanistan to try and negotiate on behalf of his brother to find a way for those leaders to come back to Afghanistan and quit fighting. And somewhere along the way, those messages were crossed, and he was picked up by U.S. forces and taken to a prison, and he was tortured pretty badly. And at that point, finally, he was released after local tribal elders interceded on his behalf. But at that point, it was too late, and the brother went back to Pakistan and declared that they will never come to terms with the Afghan government or the United States again.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we're speaking here, Anand, on the 27th of December, I'm looking at a report from yesterday's New York Times about the portion in the east part of Afghanistan, closer to the border with Pakistan. And the dateline here, Ray Rivera in Juma Kala, Afghanistan. And he writes, "Without question, security has eroded. Insurgent attacks in Anbar have surged 113% since 2008, and in neighboring Dehak, 106%. And essentially, we have been gone from there for 2 years. Foreign forces had been in the region, and the U.S. leaders decided to hand off security to Polish forces for this area, and Poland apparently decided to scale back its presence there. But the description, while it's in somewhat muted terms in the New York Times, is pretty astounding that this is an area where we basically have not had any control or presence for at least 2 years, and that this is now a Taliban stronghold. And it points up the whack-a-mole problem that, you know, once we feel that we have gained control, in whatever terms that's defined, we don't have enough forces to maintain that presence, and we don't have enough confidence in the Afghan police and military to maintain control of an area. And once again, this points up the hopelessness of attempting to control this huge, disparate country with only 100,000 American forces there.
Well, that's right. And I would say it even goes beyond just the level of forces, because as I mentioned before, you can have a large number of troops in a particular area, but and they may be able to stop some attacks and be able to hinder movement, but it's a different thing to actually be able to crush the sentiment, pro-Taliban sentiment or the sentiment against the foreign troops. That's more difficult to do with any number of troops, and that's more of a question of governance and a question of services and these sorts of things. And that's something that the troops aren't able to bring, no matter how many of them there are, and that's what they've learned in Marja.
Right. And this, of course, if we recall, in 2009, when Obama took office and authorized the first increase of troops, U.S. troops in Afghanistan, he said that he was calling for a 20% incremental increase in military spending, and 80% of new spending should be devoted to so-called nation building. But in fact, it was the flip of that. We spent about 80% on the military so-called surge, and we haven't done that much to try to, help people with building roads and schools and water facilities and those sorts of things. And so there's a kind of shuffle there between what Obama has said he was going to do and what has actually happened. And this leads to the other Obama shuffle, which was the promise that he made when he made the second incremental increase in American troops, December 1st, 2010, 2009, in his speech at West Point. And he said that, "I'm putting in 30, 35,000 more troops, but we're going to start bringing them home in the summer of 2011. And as we're speaking, that's roughly 6 months away, Anand. And we've seen General Petraeus walk back on that commitment, water it down. And yet it appears that they're going to do some photo ops and have a PR campaign to bring some troops home from Afghanistan next summer. But I don't find that very compelling. And in some ways, I find it insulting, because it appears that we really are committed to be there for at least another 5 years, if not much longer."
Well, that's right. I think at best we're going to get a photo op out of this in 2011, because there's no way there's going to be any troops that are going to be drawn down in next summer. And it was a strange sort of juxtaposition that Obama put out there, because on the one hand he said that we're going to start drawing down in July 2011, but at the same time he made it somehow conditions-based by saying that by that point the Afghan security forces will be ready to begin taking over security responsibilities. Well, that's not the case. There's really nowhere where the war is being fought in any way where they take over security responsibilities. And so we're going to see U.S. forces on the ground in all the places where the war is being fought for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Anand, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today and give us this really broad scope coverage of the past year in Afghanistan. Tell me about your plans to complete a book and when we might see it.
Well, I'm working on a book now that's looking over the last 10 years of Afghanistan and trying to understand how we got to where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be out hopefully by the end of 2011.
Okay. And do you have any plans to return to Afghanistan this year, the coming year?
Yes, I'll be back in the spring.
Okay, great. Well, I hope to talk to you before then, and if not, maybe while you're there. And again, I really appreciate the work you're doing and views that you've given us here on our situation there. Anand Gopal, thanks for joining us today.
A pleasure.
And now, Will Durst with an end-of-decade recap on the top 10 comedic stories of the last 10 years. Take it away, Will.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with the top 10 comedic news stories of the first decade of the 21st century. I know. Another top 10 list? Yes, another top 10 list. Hey, how many ends of the decade do you get in a lifetime? Maybe 7, 8, 14 if you're lucky? So deal with it, because here it comes, a list of the top 10 comedic news stories of the first decade of the 21st century. Number 10, Kerry Edwards, 04. Worst campaign ever. And that includes France in 39. Who would have thought Democrats would fondly reminisce about the charismatic Gore-Lieberman ticket? Number 9, the Clintons. still relevant. He got $12 million for his memoir. She got $8 for hers. Not bad for two people who for 8 years continually testified under oath they couldn't remember a single thing. Number 8. All the financial scandals, mostly Enron. Summed up best by the Enron Ethics Manual, sold on eBay for $250, whose seller described it as being in mint condition. Yeah, that could have been the problem. Number 7. John McCain. Old warhorse finally gets his shot. Then, couldn't remember how many houses he owned. Turned out he had 8. Should do what I do. Every time I get 4 houses, I trade them in for a hotel. Number 6. All the political sex scandals. Vitter, Foley, Edwards, Sanford, and Spitzer. The New York governor who flew a hooker from New York to D.C. because God knows there aren't enough hookers in D.C. 535 that I can think of offhand. Then he put her up at the Mayflower and gave her $4,000. Now that's a liberal, because a conservative will try to get for free at an airport men's room stall. Number 5. Barack Obama. 44th president of the United States and half black, because America's only Afro-curious. People still freaking out. Born in Kenya. No, he wasn't. He was born in Honolulu, in a manger. Number 4. Weapons of mass destruction. President Bush said he was misled into thinking Iraq had WMDs because he was provided with faulty intelligence. Yeah, DNA is a bitch. Number 3. Dick Cheney. Accidentally shot a guy in the face with a gun, then got the victim to apologize. Who amongst us hasn't mistaken a 78-year-old lawyer wearing an orange vest for a 6-foot quail? Number 2. Sarah Palin. For those of us going cold turkey in George Bush, she's like a double dose of methadone. And the number 1 comedic news story of the first decade of the 20th century has to be George W. Bush. Like if Reagan and Quayle had a kid. A Wheel of Fortune president in a Jeopardy world. For 8 wonderful years, he was single-handedly the Full Employment Act for political comedy. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Please share it with your friends and email your feedback to Peter at peterbcollins.com. Happy New Year.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until